Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 82. One Voice from Two Worlds, Native People's Stories, Part 3. Again, reading from Genocide of the Mind, New Native American Writing, edited by Mary Jo Moore. This section of the book addressing today the topic of mascots. As the word suggests, mascots are masks. The dictionary definition has a person, animal, or object believed to bring good luck as the symbol of a sports team. Well, it depends on who's being represented and how it's done. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Before getting started with the book, just a note, if you do listen to the show and you're not already on the email list and you haven't already emailed, please take a few moments and just let me know that you are listening. Would be a help to kind of gauge the listenership that is really out there. So thank you. If you are listening, thanks so much. And if you aren't, well, then you wouldn't be hearing this. But if you are listening and you haven't let me know, it'd be appreciated. Thank you. Okay, this section on use of mascots. It's called Indians as Mascots, an Issue to be Resolved. Mary Jo Moore has a short introduction to the section. For many years, the dominant society has admired the mythological Indian, but rarely the genuine person. Many today still look upon Indians as people of the past. These two beliefs have perpetuated the idea that using Indians as mascots is permissible. If one uses a term that is offensive to others without realizing it is offensive, this action can be considered stereotyping. But if one becomes informed that the term is offensive and continues to use this term, this is pure racism. After all, American Indians are human beings, not animals, and not a people of the past. Therefore, we should not be used as mascots. Though many feel there are issues of more importance and relevance that American Indian people must deal with, this issue is one that is perpetuated on a continual basis, one that strips our youth of self-assuredness. It is definitely an issue that begs to be handled in a diplomatic, respectful manner. Now, this section, after the language section, which was, you know, very lofty, insightful, stirring, beautiful, all other kinds of adjectives, the mascot section, just really emotional, sort of gut level, heartfelt feelings about what it is to be a human being, a so-called Indian, a native person, and have to deal with the kind of bias. And very powerful. I found it one of the most directly powerful sections I have read on any native literature. So I'll try not to say too much, but let the words speak for themselves. The first piece is called Symbolic Racism, History and Reality, The Real Problem with Indian Mascots by Kimberly Ropolo, R-O-P-P-O-L-O. And she is Cherokee Choctaw Creek, received her PhD specializing in Native American literature from Baylor University in 2002, full-time instructor at McLennan Community College and the Associate National Director of Wordcraft Circle of Native Writers and Storytellers. Published reviews, poems, and articles in various publications. A bunch of works in progress, and this book was from 2003. It says she resides in Hewitt, Texas, with her husband and three children. She's got a book-length work of tribal-based critical theory that was in progress then, called Collating Divergent Discourses, Positing the Critic as Culture Broker in Reading Native American Texts. So here's a longish section from her piece. I realize that many people see no problem with the use of American Indians as sports mascots. However, I think the danger of this use is more than just its potential to offend. It is representative of an endemic problem, racism against America's first peoples. Despite the fact that racial problems still exist in our country, for the most part, we are in a day and age where racial tolerance and tolerance for all kinds of diversity has increased. But this is not the case with racism against American Indians, largely because racism against American Indians is so ingrained in the American consciousness that it is invisible. Dr. Cornell Pewiwardi of the University of Kansas calls this kind of racist disconscious racism. Or, in other words, racism that the people themselves who exhibit it are unaware of. The use of American Indian mascots falls under this category. The grossly exaggerated features of the Cleveland Indian, the cartooned vicious savages decorating high school spirit ribbons, the painted, dancing, fake, buckskin-clad white kids running down the sideline doing tomahawk chops, all are unintentionally stereotypical and aren't even perceived by most Americans as negative. They fall in the same category as rock singer Ted Nugent's ridiculous stage antics and a fluorescent mockery of a Plains chief's headdress. They fall under the same category as cigar store Indians topping car dealerships. They fall under the same category as words like squaw, papoose, wagon burner, and Indian giver. They fall under the same category as Disney's painted bombshell Pocahontas and the 36-24-36 asking for it Aztec seductress from El Dorado or her grotesquely depicted male counterparts. They are no more meant to be offensive than the standard moniker chief for any American Indian male a redneck encounters in the army, the workforce, or anywhere else in America. The average American engages in this behavior without ever being aware of it, much less realizing that it is racism. Every semester I ask my students what is in the front foyer of Applebee's restaurant. None of them, not even if they work there, are ever able to tell me there is a statue of an Indian man in nonspecific tribal attire, often with a special of the day sign around his neck. Applebee's claims this statue points to the next nearest Applebee's. I guarantee that if a major restaurant chain placed a statue of an African-American man in supposed tribal dress in the front of each of its restaurants, pointing to the next nearest one, people would realize these statues were inappropriate. In the same way, as many others have pointed out, if we had sports teams named the New York Niggers or the Jersey Jigaboos, Americans would know this was wrong. The average American, who would clearly perceive the Louisville Lynched Porch Monkeys as a problematic name for a team doesn't even realize the Washington Redskins emerges from a history of the literal bloody skins of American Indian men, women, and children being worth British Crown bounty money. No one's skin is red. American Indian skin is brown, at least when it is on our bodies and not stripped from us in the name of profit and expansionism. African Americans, thank God, have raised the consciousness of Americans enough through the Civil Rights Movement to keep the more obvious forms of racism usually hidden, though it took publicly armed Black Panthers, the burning of Chicago, and even the riots of Los Angeles to get this point across. American Indians are frankly so used to being literally shot down, if we stick our heads up, we aren't nearly as likely to do so. In fact, from our own Civil Rights Movement with AIM, American Indian Movement, we still have Indians like Leonard Peltier, who stuck their heads up, although incarcerated for over 20 years, now 30 plus, I think it's like 35 or 36 perhaps, when even the FBI admits its evidence was fabricated. Racism against American Indians is so intrinsically part of America's political mythology, the truth a group of people agrees to believe about itself, that without it, this country would have to do something it has never done, face colonial guilt. Everything we see around us was made from stolen American Indian resources, resources raped from this earth that we consider sacred, an earth in danger of global disaster from imbalanced greed. Continuing, American Indian nations are the only sovereign nations the United States government has ever broken over 500 treaties with. Violations that Russell Means rightly suggests gives these nations the legal justification to issue one huge eviction notice to the United States, the only nations whose citizens are owed, even with the outright thefts not taken into account, even with the restitution of the United States Convention on Genocide should mandate under international law not taken into account, billions of dollars in money that was held in, quote, trust, unquote, for Indians, thought incapable of being responsible for it, billions of dollars that same United States government has lost. Despite this, American Indians served this country in its military forces in higher numbers per capita than any other group, ethnic group, and have in every war since the American Revolution. Here's a line that stood out. It is our conceptualization of people that dictates our behavior toward them. That's an important line, a conceptualization. You know, we have these sort of quick fix stereotypicals, you know, Jews are like this, Italians are like this, blacks, American Indians, whatever, and then that, you know, that conception can end up affecting it, obviously. Further on, she writes, in short, it is offensive for no other reason simply because it is misappropriated by those who have no right to it. Michael Jordan doesn't give the right to use his name to athletic shoe manufacturers for free and doesn't give them total laissez-faire in regard to their manipulation of his image. Why should the Seminole tribe grant this to Florida State, or the Cherokee Nation and the Comanche and the Apache and the ... tolerate this kind of use by Jeep, GMC, or other corporations? Are school traditions really more important than the elimination of images just as racist as offensive as Sambo? Can you imagine cheerleaders dressed as a sexed-up version of Aunt Jemima? No, but put one in braids, face paint, and a fringed miniskirt. Our college, university, and high school alumni will picket to defend her right to this travesty of what Indian womanhood is and was really about. We are simply asking to be recognized as people, not as television images, not as cartoons. That's the last line of her piece there. And next piece is by Alfred Youngman, a PhD Eagle Chief, is Cree and full professor and chair of Native American Studies at University of Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. Variety of published works. A piece called The Metaphysics of North American Indian Art in Indigena, Contemporary Native Perspectives. His piece is called Indians as Mascots Perpetuating the Stereotype. And it begins, some years ago, Oneida, that's upstate New York, O-N-E-I-D-A, Oneida comedian Charlie Hill, who jokes that people call him One-Eyed, took the piss out of American sports teams who use Indians for mascots in one of his many brilliant comedic routines. He said that the Atlanta Braves have a guy on the baseball field decked out in some kind of ridiculous-looking Indian outfit who does an equally idiotic Indian dance around his teepee every time his team scores. That kind of moronic antisocial behavior is not particularly endearing or surprising, coming as it does from Ted Turner's tomahawk-chopping fans, if not Ted himself. This questionable behavior has a way of reducing otherwise dignified human beings to the level of village idiots in both senses of the term. Applied here, the old adage, never argue with a fool because people may not be able to tell the difference, has never rung more true. I have never personally witnessed this infamous, grotesque dance performed, if performance it can be called, and I would never go so far as to say that it was a dance anyway. But then again, I am not a big fan of or fool for what I consider to be racist sports or games or entertainment anyway. And his continues, it is entirely possible that whatever God there is, in fact, does not work in the affairs of ordinary sports or mundane entertainment and probably never has. I am sure that God has more important things to worry about than whether or not such and such a quarterback, tight end, wide receiver, or halfback scores so many touchdowns or end runs or passes in a season, or whatever the hell the case may be. And if God is so preoccupied with such ordinary affairs, then I think that he/she has far too much time on his/her hands, so we may therefore consider the world to be in deeper doggy-do than anyone has ever imagined. Sports should be about respecting and gaining respect for one's fellow human being, and through earning that respect, about learning how to honor ourselves as human beings who are living on a tiny, definable, fragile, totally destructible planet in an unimaginably immense universe. Whether the opposing team wins or loses is hardly the point. The phrase, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game, although now widely knocked, still holds currency in this day and age. Sports should not be driven by anything other than respect and honor for everyone involved in the activity, whether it be acknowledging the rights of players, fans, families, children, referees, umpires, and yes, even Native Americans. And he goes on to cite rioting in the stadium, sometimes hockey, baseball, rugby, soccer. That's one of the reasons I pretty much totally lost interest in baseball and even basketball. It was just these fights. You know, it's a game, and all of a sudden they have these big fights, and I think of all the, you know, what kind of role model is this for young kids? He continues on here with Charlie Hill. Charlie Hill quoting, Indians love baseball, jokes Charlie Hill, but we don't set up camp in the ballpark. Hey, if the Atlanta Braves think that using Indians as mascots is simply harmless fun, then why don't we have them dress up some white guy in a three-piece suit and have him shuffle around a mobile home parked in the middle of the outfield every time their team scores a hit? Or how about changing the names of a few of these sports teams? Why not have the Atlanta White Boys or the Kansas City Caucasians or the Chicago Negroes, the Washington Jews, or New York Rednecks? Charlie Hill, may he comedic on in peace. He passed on recently. And one more little section here, talking about his son's playing hockey at school. The coach of my son's hockey team regularly called him Chief, unknown to me until I happened to be close by one day and overheard this racist bilge. Up to that point, I had been simplistically teaching my son that racism was practiced only by people with a limited education and intelligence. I was counseling him that such people did not know any better. I knew full well, of course, that Nazis in World War II were fully educated and considered to be intelligent people, but they were racist nonetheless. And the third last piece by Steve Russell, citizen of the Cherokee Nation, a high school dropout, a retired Texas trial court judge, an associate professor of criminal justice, Indiana University, Bloomington, member of the Wordcraft Circle of Native Writers and Storytellers and Native Writers Circle of the Americas. And his piece starts, I could not tell if I was dreaming. You know how it is. You wake up, but something about reality doesn't seem quite right, and you think might still be asleep, but you can't really tell. I stumbled out of bed, started the coffee machine burbling, and collected the newspaper from the front yard. The sports page told me that the New Jersey Niggers had beaten the Boston Micks. Some player on the Houston Hebes had accused the San Antonio Spicks of dropping their last game to get a higher draft pick. The league was expanding to Toronto, and since they had already honored African Americans, Irish Americans, Jewish Americans, and Hispanic Americans, they wanted to name a team to honor Native Americans. They sent out notices to all the tribal leaders, and they told us we could have whatever we wanted. Prairie Niggers, if the New Jersey team did not object. Redskins, savages, warriors, heathens, braves, bucks, and of course the cheerleaders would be the squaws, unless we wanted to modernize the language and just call them the cunts. But the tribal leaders voted for a write-in candidate, the Treaties, Toronto Treaties. It has a nice ring to it, but the League was puzzled. What kind of name is that? If the United States and Canada want to honor the First Nations, said the tribal leaders, honor our treaties. And there was a sidebar story. It seems that the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Canada had heard this and called a joint press conference. We had no idea, they said, that our countries have violated so many agreements with Native Americans. We have formed a joint commission to recommend how to make it up to the survivors, and we have each proposed legislation teaching a formal apology. And it was at that moment I knew I was dreaming. And he writes from there, from Indian mascots to the Nuagar clan of the great Wanabe nation, the Yonega whites are fascinated with connecting to Indians. Indians understood in some bizarre sense that escapes most of us. It's the same way in Europe, where grown people go prancing through the woods half naked, drumming at all hours and building teepees in places where teepees would manifestly make no sense. Teepees were good shelter for places where wood was scarce. American Indians do not build teepees in the woods. Many Americans believe they are the grandchildren of Cherokee. Why does it always have to be a Cherokee royalty? Usually a princess who came to them in a dream and told them to collect artifacts associated with Siouxian peoples. At least grandmother had a sense of humor. My grandmother had a sense of humor, too. She was Dutch, not Cherokee, abandoned as a young girl at the Sac and Fox Agency in Indian Territory, later Oklahoma. She was a bit racist, a product of her times, except in regard to Indians who had treated her well. Her daughter married a Cherokee and produced me. Bessie Van Hooser was left by her father, Samuel, at the Sac and Fox Agency so he would not be slowed down in his run for the last great piece of free land, the Cherokee Strip. Locked into that phrase, free land, was the story of my people, a story that escapes the notice of the descendants of all those Cherokee princesses. The free land came from lands declared surplus after the Curtis Act destroyed the reservations of the five tribes in Indian Territory, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole, Muskogee Creek, and Cherokee. The Dawes Commission took rolls, a census of those who would involuntarily receive a piece of the tribal homelands, a process that proceeded in spite of resistance led by the Muskogee Chito Harjo and the Cherokee Redbird Smith. The lands allotted by the Dawes Commission had been given to the tribes in perpetuity and also involuntarily in exchange for the lands of their ancestors in the southeastern U.S. The Indians were removed at gunpoint in an ethnic cleansing noted, if at all, in American history as the Trail of Tears. Cherokee lost their sacred lands and a third of their people. My great-great-great-grandmother made that walk, a lucky survivor. That's, the sort of the divide and conquer. I see it as the beginning of the suburbanization of the white people. White people not realizing they live on a kind of reservation of the empire. You know, the Dawes Act, I think that was in the 1860s, taking people and offering them their individual plots of land to people who had, no concept of ownership or individuality. So it was really a way to not only the financial control, but also to decimate the culture itself. And he continues, I first stepped up to bat in... He has a poem about baseball and his grandfather and wanting to be a baseball player like Mickey Mantle. And then he writes, I first stepped up to bat in the U.S. Air Force. Military service is a given for Indian boys. For me, it was a way to escape the menial jobs for which the public schools believed Indians were predestined. I didn't think of it that way at the time, of course. My grandparents had lost the war with the schools for my self-image. I just wanted to get through boot camp so I would not get sent back to Oklahoma without honor. As I write this, a film about Indians in the military wind talkers is skulking out of the theaters. It purports to tell the story of the Navajo code talkers in the Pacific Theater of World War II. In fact, the hero is a white guy under orders that violate the fundamental bond of honor among U.S. Marines, orders to kill his code talker if capture appears imminent. The Marine Corps, of course, flatly denied that any such orders existed. Since I am now an Indian academic, I do not have to be persuaded that the U.S. government will lie. However, after reading the histories and interviewing living code talkers, I have satisfied myself in this matter. The government is truthful. White Marines were not ordered to kill Indian Marines. Many code talkers were assigned white minders, it turns out, after several incidents where the Navajos were taken POW by American troops from other units. The purpose of the white escorts was not to protect the code talkers from the Japanese, but rather to protect them from Americans. None of the code talkers I spoke with reported any ill treatment from other troops beyond the usual stuff that was awaiting me when I enlisted in the 60s, such as the inevitable chief moniker. For some reason, Yonega either you see us as all chiefs and no Indians, or they don't know that Indians do not customarily address each other as chief or Geronimo, except for one guy I knew whose name really was Geronimo, but he was a Chicano, an Indian who got his identity taken by the Spanish rather than by the English, so he did not know he was Indian. And he writes of his son here, "My son was born in San Antonio, a military town, before it was a tourist town. Raised in Austin by an Indian father with close political alliances in the Chicano community, Paul's decisions should not have surprised me at all." And here's a poem, "Young Warrior," for Paul Russell White. "I told him, his father told him, go in this order, Air Force, Navy, Army, Marines. So naturally, he went directly to the Marine Corps recruiter. When he aced the tests and the recruiter started talking technical school, I told him, his father told him, go in this order, electronic, administrative, mechanical. So naturally, he told the Marine recruiter, combat infantry. When the assignments were made, I told him, his father told him, go in this order, stateside, Europe. So naturally, he volunteered for hazardous duty. He is not dragging canoe, stand, Wati, Irahaze, or a Diné code talker. That was then, and this is now, and he is my son. And naturally, this is how Indian sons have always served the conqueror. Semper fi. Semper fidelis, always faithful. Fidelity to what and why? We are, in fact, faithful to the government that gave us Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock, Indian treaty abrogation, and the famous words of Justice Hugo Black that Indian lawyers call the all-purpose federal Indian law dissent. Great nations, like great men, should keep their word. Wherever we see those words from Justice Black, we know we are about to have some more of our treaty rights stripped away at the whim of Congress. And yet we still fight wars for the U.S., recognizing that white Americans, while they may not always be the best of neighbors, are still neighbors." Yeah, that's another interesting angle. Winona Duke wrote about it in her book, The Militarization of Indian Country, about how much the participation natives have had fighting, you know, U.S. wars, quote, U.S. wars, and also the amount of testing of military blowing up of bombs and stuff out, I think, mostly in the Southwest. And also, if you look at the, you know, the mining going on, it's been going on for decades, Peabody Coal, and some, that's one angle, but then the uranium mining, out in the Navajo area, that uranium being used for weaponry. So along with the toxics legacy that Navajo and Hopi, I think, and I know the Navajo still dealing with the variety of the cancers, the waters poisoned. So this and it comes full circle when you talk about the you know, the attitude towards a person and then the treatment of the earth and what the resources get used for. And then how the people go along to help in some way, you know, support the use of that. You talk about a whole cultural assimilation there, and it's, so it's a big, it's a complex kind of circling there. But to really come full circle and mend the sacred hoop, we have to, you know, as much as is heard about nowadays, talk about getting through the, you know, from the spiritual, mental levels, getting through the stereotyping and the labeling, learn to treat and see each other as human beings, and while we also learn to respect them, the physical and material levels, and respect those with a spirituality. So that seems a fitting place to wrap up, and thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a spoken word piece by Teokas and Ghost Horse on his CD Kasa, KSA, and may have played this before, but it's going to play it again. It was actually put it into a little chat book form, the lyrics printed into a booklet form. If you're interested in that, let me know or check the website. and this is called Red Shift.
Circumstance we arrived at, up to this point in time of dominant history and its ill-gotten revisionism, could lead the sheeple into believing that what we are doing to the earth is the only remaining choice surviving. Capitalism, disguised in experiential democracy and its patriarchies, is showing signs of a lost investment. We must not examine the cost in body bags, body counts, nor stock exchanging itself into the illusion. Monetary value is the epiphany of so-called civilized minds. This mindset has given itself the privilege to establish immortality by destroying the very sustenance that derives life as human beings know it. It is human to only think of the human evolutionary process as elite to all life, the very political process we are demanding from each nation to nation. Across this earth to whom we belong, especially the alternative class, is exactly that. It is in the word alternative. Alternative to what? Why change the native way when it is a tried and true continuation simply because it works? No matter what anthropological theories abound within the confines of convincing you that the scientific rationale translates only rhetorical religiosities which compromise nothing but spirit. If we really get a fix, a reality fix, on who we are and where we think sanctimonious technology is taking humankind, and if we as indigenous peoples with indigenous thinking processes, which includes you, are going to be in this seventh generation, then let's face it, regardless of the situation, we are not alone, we are not inherently intelligent, we are only a strand in the web of life. You have heard it before, this is not a cliche for another boring drill to wake up. This is an urgent necessity, a dire need that you, as an individual, take the responsibility of maintaining the earth life. Its inhabitants, which come in all forms and expose the apologetic predator called guilt, sin, and blame. So this earth ramp could be used as a conjuring of spirit or simply cast aside as a throwaway society that you have come accustomed to, regardless of the situation. One thing is simple. If we continue to support and make all our decisions through the bank, we will destroy life as we know it. We will have genetically altered our spirits because we did not resist, nor struggle, nor realize our place in the universe. We must make our decisions through Mother Earth now, regardless of the situation. Regardless of the situation. Remember, real eyes, real lives, real lives.